Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso. Today we open our show with a special report from Public News Service on President Donald Trump's controversial decision to pull the U.S. out of the International Paris Climate Accord. Then on our Capitol report, learn what's in President Trump's proposed budget, what programs are slated for increased funding, and which ones are set to be slashed. Hear about a new law that cancels internet privacy protections and allows internet companies to sell your browsing history, and find out which local legislators voted for the measure after pocketing five-figure contributions from the telecom industry. Learn about shooting bans and other fire protection steps taken by federal and state agencies to prevent wildfires on public lands in our area. Then hear our analysis of redistricting decisions made by El Cajon's City Council. Plus, we'll tell you about a new animal shelter that's broken ground in East County and about controversies in two local jurisdictions over what gets on the agenda and just who decides. Our newsmaker interview today is with a very special guest, Morgan Cook, the San Diego Union-Tribune reporter who's been named Journalist of the Year by the Society of Professional Journalists for her investigative reporting that helped lead to a Justice Department criminal investigation of Congressman Duncan Hunter over alleged personal use of more than $60,000 in campaign money. On Destination East County, hear about all the top festivals and events coming up, including La Mesa's Flag Day Parade and an outdoor desert concert at Inkopa this weekend, as well as Father's Day festivities and more special events coming soon. And finally, on our sports report, hear about a big win by the Grossmont College baseball team, the new state champions. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
Welcome to the Public News Service Daily Newscast for Friday, June 2nd, 2017. I'm Eric Tegedoff. Donald Trump made good on a campaign promise to pull the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Accord, making the announcement Thursday in the Rose Garden. Defending his decision, the president remarked, "It is time to put Youngstown, Ohio, Detroit, Michigan, and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, before Paris, France." Nicaragua and Syria are the only two other countries not to join the accord. The Central American country said the agreement wasn't strong enough. And as Andrea Sears reports, the decision has drawn sharp criticism from scientists and environmentalists.
The announcement wasn't a surprise. Trump frequently derided the agreement as a job killer during his presidential campaign. But Fred Kowal, president of United University Professions, calls the decision a denial of scientific fact that endangers the planet, puts the interests of polluters over the health and well-being of the American people, and weakens the United States in the eyes of the world.
It is remarkably short-sighted on environmental grounds, on economic grounds, on international diplomatic grounds. It's just a remarkable step for the president to take.
He notes that withdrawal from the Paris Agreement would take 4 years to complete, potentially making it an issue in the 2020 presidential election.
The decision has also rattled the business world, with some energy market and job creation watchers saying that leaving the agreement will put America behind the rest of the world.
Han Chen watches energy economics for the Natural Resources Defense Council. She says internationally and here in the U.S., the fastest job growth has been in clean energy. She says energy efficiency and renewables have added 3 million new jobs.
California, Virginia, New York, and other states have put in place limits on carbon pollution, that they're doing trading systems for emissions.
The coal industry and its political allies have argued that the climate agreement is part of what they describe as a war on coal, but Chen says 1,100 U.S. companies have publicly declared that they favor the Paris Accord. Dan Hyman reporting.
This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital.
This is Gene Carpenter with the Capitol Report. President Donald Trump's budget has been deemed harmful and illogical by some, while others defend and praise the plan. So what does it actually do? The proposed budget would boost defense spending by 10% and also increase funds for border security, but slash funding for most other departments. Programs focused on science, research, social welfare, and foreign aid are getting knifed. Among the deepest cuts are to the Environmental Protection Agency and the State Department, each facing 30% cuts. The programs marked for cuts or increases are largely consistent with Trump's announced goals during his campaign. Predictably, House Speaker Paul Ryan applauded the plan as fiscally responsible and said that Obama never even proposed to balance the budget. Ryan added, "So what I see is a president keeping his promises." But California Senator Kamala Harris issued a statement blasting the budget. "At its core, this budget is a cruel betrayal of the middle class and threatens our ability to ensure basic public safety, public health, and public education," she said. Harris criticized the budget for reducing taxes for the wealthiest Americans and giving corporations big tax breaks while taking away Social Security for disabled Americans, tax credits for families with children, and resources for students trying to pay for college. California's senator adds that the budget spends billions of dollars on a wall that won't work while cutting access to health care and initiatives to cure cancer. "I will stand up, speak out, and fight against the budget at every turn, just as I will fight against this administration's efforts to strip health care from millions," Harris concludes, adding, "We are better than this." One of the most interesting reactions came from Republican Mark Sanford, part of a hard-right group that Budget Director Mick Mulvaney helped found. At a budget hearing, he ripped into the logistic values that the plan is trying to project upon America, calling the economic growth rate claimed by the president's plan a lie. Sanford does not believe that it is possible to build a working budget on a 3% economic growth. He even went as far as to call the budget a fairy tale, stating, "Whatever your budget is, just base it on real numbers, and then let's have a food fight. But let's not base it on fooling the American public and believing that you can do all this." Sanford wasn't the only one who questioned the math of President Trump's budget. Many different sites have commented on the phantom $2 trillion, a mathematical error in the budget where President Trump counts the same $2 trillion twice to justify his huge tax cuts. Eventually, Trump's administration tried to rectify the situation, which caused even more hysteria as his White House budget director and Treasury secretary contradicted each other. The projected $2 trillion savings that Trump claims his budget would produce doesn't exist in the eyes of many top economists. A survey by University of Chicago Booth School of Business found a rare show of unanimity. Of 42 economists surveyed, 100% of them agreed that Trump's budget will not create enough economic growth to offset the lost federal revenue and would actually add to the national debt. So how would Trump's budget affect San Diego? Our county is a major hub for the green, clean energy sector, which faces huge cuts in Trump's new budget plan. San Diego is also in the nation's top five life science clusters. Trump's plan aims to cut around 22% of the National Institute of Health's budget, which could be very damaging to medical and scientific research. On the flip side, the budget does give a 5.5% rise in the budget for Veterans Affairs and also provides for modest rates for active duty military and civilians working for the military, which could help the many military families and others employed by the Defense Department in our region.
This is Jonathan Getz. Your internet provider can now legally sell your browsing history and your email address without your consent, thanks to legislation signed into law by President Trump. The measure passed the Senate by just 2 votes and the House by only 10 votes. San Diego Republican Congressman Duncan Hunter and Daryl Issa both voted for the measure after taking $19,000 and $66,000 from the telecommunications industry, respectively. By contrast, San Diego Democratic congressional members Susan Davis and Juan Vargas took no money from the telecommunications industry and both voted against the measure, according to the National Institute on Money in State Politics. California's two senators, Dianne Feinstein and Kamala Harris, also voted no. The new law blocks landmark privacy regulations adopted by the Federal Communications Commission, or FCC, during the Obama administration that were set to go into effect and would have blocked companies such as Google, Comcast, or AT&T from saving and selling customers' browsing histories, The Washington Post reports. The action has sparked alarm among privacy rights advocates. Imagine having not only your shopping habits, but sensitive information such as your medical history or embarrassing details such as your preferred underwear styles revealed to anyone willing to pay for it. Thieves might learn when you're on vacation by perusing your browsing history on airline flights. Investigative journalists, police officers, or private investigators could potentially find their work, safety, or even their lives put at risk. Angry constituents of Arizona Senator Jeff Flake, the bill's author, responded with heckling at his town hall meeting. Activists also put up a billboard which reads, "Flake betrayed you. He took $186,000 from telecoms, then he voted to let them sell your web history without permission." It then encourages constituents to call and ask him why. The measure has been condemned by consumer groups and privacy rights advocates, but was supported by telecom companies and the Chamber of Commerce. Business interests see opportunities in buying consumers' browsing history in order to market products or services. Articles on major media sites about the vote drew near universal opposition in comment sections among Trump voters as well as liberals.
Aiming to prevent future wildfires, the Federal Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, has announced a ban on target shooting, campfires, and other high-risk activities for all BLM-managed public lands in San Diego County and several other Southern California counties. The announcement came just days after Supervisor Diane Jacobs sent a letter to BLM officials calling for a ban on shooting after the Gate Fire scorched over 2,000 acres in the Dulzura area earlier this month. A video posted online suggested that shooters on BLM lands may have started the Gate Fire, and CAL FIRE has launched a criminal investigation. Numerous recent smaller fires have been confirmed to have been caused by target shooting on BLM land in the Jamul and Dulzura areas. Angry residents and Supervisor Jacob have long been calling for bans on shooting at these sites, particularly during the dry season. CAL FIRE has already banned target shooting on state-controlled lands due to fire danger. The new ban extends to federal lands. The restrictions prohibit open fire of any kind in the designated areas, including campfires, fireworks, sky lanterns, and other devices with open flames. Smoking is permitted only in enclosed vehicles. Portable stoves with controlled flame devices are allowed only with a permit. Fire restrictions will remain in effect until further notice, with the ban on recreational shooting lasting until the end of fire season. Anyone violating the order could not only face fines, but also be held criminally liable for damage if a fire results from their actions. BLM California District Manager Beth Ransel says, despite heavy winter rains, restrictions are needed due to current hot and dry weather conditions and an abundance of dry grass that could be easily ignited. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
El Cajon City Council has selected a map for redistricting following a long public process. After voters approved changing from at-large to district elections, where each community will have its own representative, council invited the public to draw up their own proposed maps. Over 200 maps were received and several public hearings were held. El Cajon is a city that's undergone demographic upheavals over the past decade. Minorities are now the majority, due to an influx of refugees and immigrants from Iraq and elsewhere in the Middle East, many Mexican and other Latino residents, and an increase in the city's African-American population. Each group has its own set of issues, ranging from police and community relations in the wake of the Alfred Alongo shooting, to language and outreach for the city's large Middle Eastern population. Council, in consultation with a demographics consulting firm, narrowed the choices to a handful of maps and, last week, held a lively hearing to choose a final map. Public opinion was split, with African Americans, Latinos, and Iraqi Chaldean representatives all testifying for different map options. The Chaldean community itself was split. Chaldean American Councilman Ben Colasso sent a letter threatening to sue the district if it chose a map that could cost him his seat on the council as the only minority representative. But other Chaldeans spoke on behalf of a different map. Ultimately, council chose a map drawn by Paul Serco, a Republican who ran unsuccessfully for council in 2016. Council voted 3-2, with three Republicans voting in favor, while Councilmember Steve Goebel, a Republican, and Colasso, a Democrat, voted against it. The map puts Councilman Colasso and Gary Kendrick in the same district, but also has Councilmembers Steve Goebel and Bob McClellan sharing a district. That means, besides four members vying for just two seats, two other districts will have open seats, guaranteeing at least two new faces on the board. The plan chosen actually creates three majority-minority districts. The minority definition used by the city is broad, including language minorities such as Arabic speakers, as well as all classes protected under state and federal voting rights acts. The mayor will remain an at-large position elected by all voters in El Cajon. Colasso has indicated that instead of running against Kendrick in 2018, he plans to challenge Wells for mayor. Whether he wins the mayoral race or loses and steps down due to redistricting, a replacement for his seat would ultimately be made, meaning perhaps as many as three new faces on the El Cajon City Council. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Getz.
This is Rebecca Williamson with a report from El Cajon. Dogs, cats, and other pets awaiting adoption in El Cajon will soon have some spacious new digs. The long-awaited El Cajon Animal Shelter is finally under construction after years of planning and design. A groundbreaking ceremony was held last week, with the new shelter expected to open by fall 2018. The new facility on North Marshall Avenue will replace a 50-year-old structure nearby and is twice the size of the older building with room to grow. The new shelter will include housing for animals awaiting adoption, veterinary services for sick and injured shelter pets, grooming, play and exercise areas, pet adoption services, and administrative offices. The building's modern style of architecture will include playful pet images on the exterior. The shelter's estimated $9.3 million cost is funded by Proposition O, special revenues, a half-cent sales tax increase that voters approved back in 2004. The special tax ended in 2015. Now, taxpayers are finally seeing the results of those revenues to improve life for pets in the city's animal shelter.
Who should decide what items wind up on the agenda for a public board? Should a chair or a board majority have unlimited power, or should each member have the right to add agenda items, and if so, how many? These are questions that members of multiple local boards have been wrestling with recently. In El Cajon, newly elected Councilmember Ben Colasso advised the council that he has more than 60 items he'd like to add to the agenda over the next year. But the entire council, with all members combined, has added only a handful of items to the agenda in the past year, though some other items were added at the request of staff or members of the public. Too many agenda items can take valuable staff time to research, drawing time away from other items that may be more timely or important, some members have argued. El Cajon's council considered a measure to require approval by two council members to put an item on the agenda, a concept that La Mesa City Council considered and rejected. Opponents point out that both cities have four Republicans and one Democrat, raising the potential for one party to control the agenda. El Cajon also opted against that option, but last week approved a plan to hold two public hearings a year in which members of the public and council members can propose and discuss possible agenda items. Council would then determine which items to prioritize. Councilman Ben Colasso, the only Democrat and minority as an Iraqi Chaldean serving on the council, objected to the plan and called it a muzzle ordinance. However, it passed 4-1. Meanwhile, on the Alpine Community Planning Group, conservative member Lou Russo asked for equal time to present an opposing view after a fire chief presented an argument in favor of annexation by the Alpine Fire Department of an area previously covered by the Rural Fire Protection District. The item was informational only and no vote was taken. The chair denied Russo's request for equal time. County Council later affirmed that in the case of community planning groups, a chair does have power to set agendas even over the objections of one or more fellow members. These cases raise important questions about the democratic process and what protections, if any, should be provided to protect elected officials' ability to voice their views, even if those opinions are unpopular with a board's majority. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Gene Carpenter.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. Today, my very special guest is Morgan Cook. She is a member of the San Diego Union-Tribune's investigative reporting team. She's previously worked for the North County Times and the Orange County Register. She's covered subjects ranging from local government to campaign finance. And now, she's been named the 2017 Journalist of the Year by the Society of Professional Journalists in San Diego for her series of investigative reports on none other than Congressman Duncan Hunter's campaign expenses. In announcing the award, the professional journalism group stated, "San Diego has seen its share of big stories this past year, but our board believes no local journalist did better work than Cook in her relentless accountability reporting on Congressman Duncan Hunter's use of campaign funds for personal expenses. She broke the story last year and continues to follow it after the Department of Justice made clear in March that it is investigating Congressman Hunter." Now, in the 21 stories that she's written about Hunter's troubles, Cook explained to readers why this matters, opening up the possibility of undue influence by showing just who was giving money to Hunter and what they might be getting in return. Now, we should add, in all fairness, that Congressman Hunter has denied any wrongdoing, though he did take out a loan and repay his campaign about $60,000 for items that appeared to be personal expenses, and he is under federal investigation by the Justice Department for his action, in large part due to the reporting of today's guest, Morgan Cook. Morgan, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, can we start off by having you tell us what tipped you off? What were the red flags that first made you decide to start investigating Congressman Hunter's finances?
In April of last year, the FEC, the Federal Election Commission, sent a letter to Hunter's campaign that was posted publicly on its website. And the letter asked for additional information about some particular expenditures that he had marked, the campaign had marked as personal and needing to be reimbursed. And the expenses were tuition to his children's private school and some expenses for video games from an online video game provider.
Very interesting. So what steps did you do to start tracking down the story from there? And what did Hunter's office say about that when you asked them?
Well, when we first asked them about the expenses that the FEC questioned, Hunter explained that the tuition payment was intended to be a charitable contribution.
From his campaign? Since when do campaigns make charitable contributions?
Actually, kind of a lot.
Okay.
But anyway, he said that it was intended to be a charitable contribution, but somehow was entered by the school as tuition. And it was just a mistake, miscommunication.
Okay.
And then with the video games, he said that his son had asked if he could, you know, stream these video games. And Hunter said, yeah, you can. You can get the credit card out of my wallet. But the son picked up the wrong credit card. Apparently they're both blue.
Yeah. I heard the credit card story, I kind of laughed because we had that same mistake in our household where somebody used the wrong credit card. And, you know, my husband would say, why did you use this credit card instead of the one where you get the, Costco bonus points or something? Mm-hmm. So it actually sounded like it could be credible at that point. So what made you think that there was more to the story than maybe just a couple of possibly innocent mistakes?
The main reason I thought that is that after that story ran, I thought to myself, well, let's just make sure that these sort of issues haven't really cropped up before. I'll just go back through earlier campaign finance reports and just have a little look-see.
Yeah.
And I started seeing some expenses that are just, that just seemed unusual, very unusual compared to what you typically see.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us some examples?
Yeah, sure. There was an expenditure to an oral surgeon in El Cajon, which, you know, the campaign purpose of that seemed, not obvious to me.
Did they have an explanation for that?
I think the explanation for that was a mix-up in the credit cards.
Again?
I think so.
So how many times do you mix up the credit card? What else? So you started looking back and
You found a lot of other anomalies. One that stuck in my mind was a European family vacation over Thanksgiving with some really big expenses, including things like hotels and meals. But you didn't just take the campaign's word for what these were. So tell us what happened when you started picking up the phone and actually calling to ask about some of these things.
When we started seeing that there were questionable expenditures, you know, that were fairly obvious to us, right? And then we saw that there were expenditures in Italy. Any international expenditures for a campaign are something that you might want to have a closer look, right? Because it doesn't mean that they are illegal. It doesn't mean that mistakes were made. But you might want to have a closer look, you know?
Correct.
So we did. And, you know, we found pictures on his social media accounts, you know, popular tourist destinations and things. So we started carefully combing through and seeing where all of these places that they'd been paying, like where they were and stuff. And actually we found the jewelry store and gave them a call because it said that there was food and beverages. But, you know, it was an Italian name. We didn't know if it was a restaurant or what. We were just going through.
And it turned out to be a high-end jewelry store. And what did they tell you?
They said that they do not sell food and beverages.
Interesting. Okay, so the campaign charitably was mistaken about that, maybe about the whole trip.
Maybe. I don't know.
Very interesting. Another interesting one was first-class airfare, $600 worth for his child's pet rabbit. What did the campaign have to say about that one?
Well, actually, the campaign admitted that, or I guess they made that public on their own. Because
after these other things came out.
Right. Because the Office of Congressional Ethics had prepared a report, and apparently they had seen it, and they were saying that perhaps the Office of Congressional Ethics was a little out of control, gone a little far, you know, and they just were saying that everything was clearly wrong.
So they were sort of in damage control mode at that point.
Right. And they used this as an example of saying, look, clearly this was a mistake. You know, clearly this was a mistake. But the Office of Congressional Ethics isn't sort of accepting that explanation.
When did you first realize just how serious this was and what the potential ramifications might be?
I started to think it was pretty serious when we started uncovering kind of a large volume of expenses over kind of a long time. I'm talking like 180 something.
180.
I think. I don't have that number off the top of my head, but it was quite a few.
Okay. So it was a lot. What were some of the biggest challenges that you faced in this investigation?
It was hard to verify things and get explanations because Hunter's office declined to comment or answer a lot of our questions.
We've had that issue at times from that office as well.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm sure they have their reasons. It made things a little harder for me because I really am interested in knowing what happened.
Right, and I think if there was an innocent explanation that they would want your readers to know that.
Yes.
Okay. All right. We'll leave it at that. Maybe there is one. If so, I would like to add, if Congressman Hunter's staff is listening to this, we would welcome the opportunity to have those answers to any of the questions that Morgan has asked that haven't yet been answered. Some people say that campaign finance violations, really in the grand scheme of things, don't matter that much to voters. Morgan, why do you think this is important, and why do you believe that people should care, whether it's Duncan Hunter or any other politician?
I think that people should care because campaign finance is important because it allows people with special interests to get access to the candidate. They get to talk to the candidate, and they can explain their perspective on things that they think the country needs, you know, issues that they would like to see addressed and all of those things. But the people who don't go to the campaign events, who might have another side of the story, don't get the same access, right?
Yeah.
So office holders, they understand the arguments. They believe them. They think that that person has a very strong point and good expertise, but they haven't really heard the other side of the story. So they may make decisions that are more in the interests of their campaign contributors than, you know, the silent taxpayers who didn't get to weigh in on that.
Yeah. And I suppose that it also goes to somebody's ethics in general. If there is a misuse of campaign funds that perhaps was not unintentional, you know, what does that say about the person's ethics overall, the person that you're counting on in Congress to hopefully stand up for the voters that he was elected to represent?
I think that the concern is that they might lose sight of that, mm-hmm. you know, and they might end up doing favors that they don't perceive as doing favors, you know, that the office holder doesn't perceive it as doing a favor. But
yeah, interestingly, we just published our own report that our wonderful new intern Jordan helped us on, authored actually. And in this report, he revealed that Congressman Hunter took $16,000 in donations from the tobacco industry in the last campaign cycle. And right after that, he introduced legislation that would weaken regulations on vaping and e-cigarettes, basically say the FDA can't look into what's in these things before they're put out on the market. And of course, they have carcinogens and all sorts of things in them. That kind of ties in with your report on fundraisers that he's held or that have been held for him at cigar lounges, literally smoke-filled rooms with lobbyists and well-heeled donors there. Do you think that campaign finance reforms are needed to better protect the public interest? I mean, what is the answer to this situation?
I think it would be great if there were more transparency about who goes to these events. You know, when the campaign spends money to, you know, to host an event or have an event, buy dinner for donors, those types of things, I think it would be great to know if it was a campaign fundraiser, who is there?
You know?
And those details are not required and are not disclosed.
Good point. Something like that, we really don't know. Was this just a lot of his individuals and friends and longtime, you know, people who just support his conservative principles maybe? Or was this people that were lobbyists for the tobacco industry or executives from the tobacco industry that were there sort of, you know, whining and dining him to support their agenda? We just don't know.
Right. We don't have a great way to figure that out.
Yeah. No. And we should note that Hunter, his reason that he's given for why he introduced this legislation was to help businesses that sell the tobacco products, and also because he believes that vaping has helped him to quit smoking cigarettes, although, of course, he still smokes the electronic cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
But in his mind, that's better.
He's been a longtime proponent of vaping.
Correct. So, what reactions have you had from readers since your series broke? And how do you, I'm curious what you've heard. Has it been positive or negative? And how do you deal with any critics?
Most of the emails that, you know, I've gotten from readers, calls and emails, have been actually very supportive. You know, thank you for your coverage. We need this type of information. It's good for us to know. But there have been also emails and calls from readers who've said, look, you know, you're after this poor person because he's a Republican, and, you know, is this just some kind of witch hunt?
How do you respond to that?
I mean, I try to explain that our business is really about facts and rules, and facts and rules don't really change based on the political opinions of a reporter or the editors or the paper. And we try to hold all public officials, regardless of their parties, accountable to the rules.
Yeah, ironically, aren't you also the reporter who looked into campaign finance controversies involving Doug Applegate, who was the Democratic candidate running against Republican Congressman Daryl Issa?
I did. And, you know, I've looked into unions, I've looked into lots of people from different political parties.
So it's really not about party, it's about integrity and really doing your job as a journalist to reflect the public interest and not protecting or promoting any particular individual or party.
Right. That is what we try very hard to do.
Okay.
What I try very hard to do.
Now, your reporting was largely responsible, I'm sure, for the House Ethics Commission deciding that it would look into this. And then later, the U.S. Justice Department announced that it's conducting its own probe, and the Ethics Commission has backed off under the request of the Justice Department right now, which is customary, listeners, that the Justice Department wants to be able to question witnesses, subpoena them if necessary, first in cases like this. Can you give us some background, Morgan, on what all of this might mean for Congressman Hunter's future? How has the Justice Department handled similar cases in the past where there were issues raised about substantial personal expenditures charged up to a campaign?
Well, one of the cases that I think leaps to everyone's mind is Jesse Jackson Jr.
A Democrat.
A Democrat, yes. Mm-hmm. And he was from Illinois, and he was indicted, and, you know, the indictment said he spent money on, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars of campaign money on things like Rolex watches and fur coats and things.
Yeah.
And, okay. You know, interestingly, his wife was his campaign consultant, campaign manager. She's being paid by his campaign for her services.
No,
she also was indicted, and both of them ended up in prison.
Now, am I correct that Congressman Hunter's wife has also been a paid staffer or consultant on his campaign as well?
Yes, and for quite some time, and through the end of February of this year.
Now, it's not necessarily illegal to hire a relative to work on your campaign?
It is not illegal. It has been approved by, I believe, the Committee on Ethics.
So what makes it over the line, say, in Jesse Jackson Jr.'s case, what was the red flag?
Experts who I've spoken to have said that the risks there, right, are that this a safeguard against problematic spending, personal spending perhaps, is sort of diminished when both the campaign manager and the candidate could have a shared personal benefit.
Got it.
The protections, the safety nets aren't as good.
Yeah.
Or they might not be. They might be.
But. So I read one story that indicated there have been in recent years about four cases that were somewhat similar to his in terms of what the allegations were. Two of those, the member of Congress did wind up in jail and prison and resigning from office, and one of the others has just been indicted, and as of when I researched it a couple of weeks ago, the fourth one, there was a grand jury being convened to decide whether to file charges or not. So what usually happens if a Justice Department does decide they're going to indict? And of course, they could clear him also. We don't know. We don't know that. But if they decide that there's material worthy of indicting somebody who's a member of Congress, how is that typically handled?
The office holder actually typically resigns.
So there's no congressional rule that says they have to do that.
Right. No, no. And many of them have continued holding office even after they were convicted of a crime.
Amazing.
You know, it depends. But most lawmakers who are indicted, they tend to resign because it's sort of, it can sometimes be part of a plea deal.
Correct.
And
or a party may pressure them if they feel that they're not strong enough to get reelected at that point.
It may become harder for them to do their job because constituents are angry and hassling them all the time. They may just not like to have to put up with all the public scrutiny. I mean, it can't be that fun.
Yeah, exactly. So. Now, in all fairness, we should state that after this investigation broke, and it was all over the media, national media and local media, that Congressman Hunter did do the right thing, and he did repay his campaign about $60,000, including some of which he said, you know, maybe wasn't personal expenses, but to be absolutely sure, he repaid back everything.
Since we started asking questions in April of last year, it's been about $62,000.
$62,000. But he didn't just have this money sitting around in an account somewhere. He didn't just write a check for it. He actually took out a loan, I understand. Is that correct?
Yes. He took out a third loan secured by his home in Alpine.
Well, that's interesting. If things like oral surgery and vacations to Italy were really personal expenses and he really meant to pay for them out of his personal funds and it was just a mistake with the wrong credit card or something, you would think he would have that money on hand in the account. But you're saying he didn't.
Not to my knowledge. It appears that he did not. And, you know, that sort of could intensify concerns a little bit, you know, because it sort of speaks to his financial situation and raises the sort of specter that perhaps he was supplementing income with the campaign.
Very.
Then that may be so far off target, but that is the concern.
Yeah, it's certainly the appearance that it would seem to perhaps have.
Right.
You're right. Well, this isn't the first time that he's been in the headlines making controversies. A couple of years ago in 2014, Washingtonian Magazine had the dubious honor of naming him the biggest party animal in Washington, D.C. They always list the best and worst of legislators, and they have the legislative staffers back there in Washington vote for this. So that was kind of an interesting thing. Makes you kind of wonder where all that money might have been going.
Yes. I wonder. I would love to know.
There you go. Well, I'm certainly looking forward, Morgan, to reading more of your reports the next time the next round of campaign finance reports for him comes out. And keep up the great work.
Thank you so much. I will try.
Okay. Well, listeners, if you've just tuned in, we have been speaking with Morgan Cook, who is the award-winning investigative reporter for the San Diego Union-Tribune, whose investigation of Congressman Hunter has led to a congressional ethics probe and a Department of Justice criminal investigation into his finances. Morgan, I want to congratulate you again on your big award being named Journalist of the Year by the Society of Professional Journalists. I know you're going to be picking up your award at their banquet in July at the Kona Kai Hotel here. For any listeners who may want to attend the SPJ big event, can you tell us, though, what the honor means to you?
The honor is huge. I mean, I'm so touched. I am so flattered. I'm so excited because, you know, it sort of speaks to the San Diego media's commitment to, you know, doing this kind of work, doing it even when people push back, holding public officials accountable, and just keeping on and keeping on until we get to the closest obtainable version of the truth. And even when it's hard, you know, and I think that that's especially important for us to demonstrate now when there's been so much criticism of the media and accusations of fake news flying around.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. We've seen on the one hand, there actually has been a lot of fake news lately. That seems to be a phenomenon we're all having to deal with. And we have even the president himself being very critical of journalists and calling longtime reputable organizations like the Washington Post, whose reporting, you know, resulted in the Watergate findings and bringing down the president, Richard Nixon, for obstruction of justice, basically. The New York Times, even calling these credible organizations fake news. What advice would you give to young, up-and-coming journalists today in this era who want to be respected as journalists? What words of wisdom would you have for them?
I would suggest that they just keep doing their work and doing it to the best of their ability, to just keep doing what we've always done, which is find facts, vet them, try to verify information, and then report what we know to the best of our ability. And I think that facts will protect us from those types of accusations because it's the truth.
Yeah, well, that's what the First Amendment is all about. And it's noteworthy, I think, that our founding fathers enshrined journalism as the only profession that is actually constitutionally protected in the Bill of Rights.
We have a job to do. It's an important one.
Well, keep up the good work, and I want to thank you so much, Morgan, for taking time out of your busy schedule to come on our show today and join us today on the East County Magazine show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been an honor.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show. ¶¶
Welcome to Destination East County with your hosts, Rebecca Williamson
and Jonathan Getz, bringing you the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County
each week.
This week's Destination East County includes Fly Day at Gillespie Field in El Cajon, the Ingapa Outdoor Overnight Concert at Hakumba's Desert View Tower, La Mesa's Flag Day Parade, and Family Day at the Von Almarine Dairy in Lakeside.
Plus, we'll tell you about coming attractions, including Lavender Day at Summers Past Farms, the Julian Dance, Fido Fest in Santee, summer concerts in La Mesa and Santee, A Taste of La Mesa, Night Fishing, the Julian Blues Festival, a Father's Day brunch with Cowboy Jack, a Father's Day adventure at Fort Cross, the Secret Life of Pets movie at Santee Lakes, Julian's 4th of July parade, plus Independence Day events with fireworks in Santee and El Cajon.
So stay tuned for all these events and many more.
Air Group 1 and Gillespie Field Cafe invite you to Fly Days at Gillespie Field on the first Friday of each month. The next Fly Days event is on June 2nd from 4 to 8 p.m. when the Gillespie Field Cafe comes alive with live music, hot rod cars, antique airplanes, and World War II aircraft. For more information, you can visit GillespieCafe.com.
The Ingapa, an outdoor concert under the stars at the Desert View Tower in Hakumba, will be held on Saturday night, June 3rd. This is an overnight camping experience perched on a rocky hillside overlooking the Anza Borrego Desert, offering music lovers and naturalists alike a unique evening of music and frolicking under the night sky. 16 bands from California and Arizona are slated to perform in this special Best of the Southwest event. Reservations are required. For tickets and details, you can visit ingapa.org.
La Mesa salutes Old Glory and the city's annual Flag Day Parade on Saturday, June 3rd. The parade begins at 10 a.m. in La Mesa's downtown village, led by the U.S. 3rd Marine Air Force Wing Band. You can cheer on equestrian groups, war heroes, marching bands, and more. Guests are encouraged to wear red, white, and blue and show patriotic spirit. Arrive early for pre-parade concerts starting at 9 a.m. by local school bands. After the parade, you can stop by Legacy Park for free ice cream on La Mesa Boulevard between 4th and Allison Avenue. For more information, visit cityoflamesa.com/special events.
June is National Dairy Month. To celebrate, Van Almarine Dairy and Oma's Pumpkin Patch in Lakeside invite you to celebrate during the Family Day at the Dairy on Saturday, June 3rd, with tours, ice cream, and play activities from slides and swings to a petting zoo. Gates open at 9:30 a.m. and close at 4 p.m. There are tours at several times throughout the day of the dairy farm on a tractor-drawn hayride. Guests are welcome to pack a picnic and enjoy lunch at the farm. Learn more at omaspumpkinpatch.com.
Now for a preview of coming attractions.
Summers Past Farms in Flint Springs invites you to Lavender Day, which also includes an antique and craft fair on Saturday, June 10th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. You can celebrate the fragrance and beauty of lavender, shop for lavender plants and lavender-scented gifts, and find over 40 craftsmen and expert artisans offering crafts, collectibles, antiques, and a garden sale. Jim Earp will provide live music which you can listen to on the lawn or at a coffee bar. Guests are encouraged to wear lavender. For details, you can visit summerspastfarms.com.
Sons of the American Legion will present the 11th annual Julian Dance on June 10th from 2 p.m. to 10 p.m. The Backcountry Dance and Barbecue features music by Three Chord Justice and the California Rangers, a large dance floor, plus dinner slow-cooked Santa Maria style over open oakwood flames. Foods, wines, and beers are available for purchase. This event is described as a throwback to a simpler time with twinkly lights and bonfires backdropped by dark mountain skies, a time for mountain residents and visitors to get together for a great time. To listen to the bands or get tickets, you can visit juliandance.org.
The city of Santee will be hosting VitoFest on June 10th from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m., along with Camp Bow Wow. VitoFest will be held at Town Center Community Park East. You can adopt a dog from any of the dozens of rescue groups on hand, win giveaways, enjoy live entertainment, get discounts on vaccinations, microchipping, and dog licenses, and bid on silent auction prizes to benefit Dogs on Deployment, which helps deployed military members find volunteers to board their pets. Details can be found on the City of Santee's webpage.
La Mesa's Summertime Sundays at 6 concerts season begins June 11th and will be held each Sunday evening from 6 p.m. through July 23rd at Harry Griffin Park. Opening night will feature the San Diego Concert Band on June 11th. Other performers this season will include Ginger Cowgirl, Fanny and the Attaboys, Dim the Lights, Fringe Benefits, and Sonic Epidemic. For more information, visit lamesaparks.org.
The La Mesa Chamber of Commerce invites you to enjoy tastings from dozens of local restaurants, caterers, pubs, and more at the 9th Annual Taste of La Mesa, being held on Monday, June 12th from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. at the La Mesa Community Center. Guests can savor options such as gourmet sausages, Himalayan cuisine, farm-fresh foods, beer, and other beverages. For reservations and a full list of participating restaurants, caterers, and beverage providers, you can visit lamesachamber.com.
You're invited to come drop a line during night fishing at Santee Lakes on Thursday, June 15th from 5 p.m. to 11:30 p.m. Bring a lantern. For details, visit santeelakes.com.
Santee kicks off its summer concert series with the Cadillacs on June 15th from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at Town Center Park East. This event also features a classic car show, kids' activities, picnic-style seating, as well as food trucks. For details, go to the City of Santee's webpage.
Fort Cross and Julian invites you to bring Dad for a Father's Day adventure on June 17th that includes rugged, manly, fun things like a tomahawk throwing competition, archery contest, and paintball slingshot area. The family can enjoy a petting zoo, sunset hayride, dinner, and playing jug band instruments around a campfire. You can spend the day or even camp overnight. Space is limited for this manly Father's Day adventure. You can reserve tickets for dear old Dad and the whole family at fortcross.com.
The 19th Annual Julian Blues Festival is set for June 17th at the Mangini Winery. Tickets and a schedule of bands are available at robbrowerpresents.com.
Pine Hills Lodge will host a Father's Day brunch on Sunday, June 18th. Cowboy Jack will sing traditional country music from Hank Williams, Johnny Cash, Merle Haggard, Willie Nelson, and more, also playing acoustic guitar and harmonica. Cowboy Jack Johnson is the lead singer from the Band in Black and the Singing Cowboy at Rawhide Ranch. For reservations and details, visit pinehillslodge.com.
Santee Lakes invites you to watch The Secret Life of Pets on an outdoor movie screen on Friday, June 23rd from 6 to 10 p.m. Before the movie, Wild Wonders will do a presentation, plus you can meet animal ambassadors from all over the world, including rainforest kinkajou, hairy armadillos, great horned owls, African hedgehogs, North American alligators, boa constrictors, and porcupines. Find directions at santeelakes.com and check the Santee Lakes Facebook page for listings of additional movies and more all summer long.
Julian proudly proclaims its annual 4th of July parade to be the best small-town parade in America. The parade starts with the firing of a cannon and also includes early flyovers by vintage aircraft, a gunfight, and bank robbery from 10 a.m. to noon. The parade itself rolls out at noon and includes equestrians, marching bands, bagpipers, floats, and more. Plus, there's a barbecue and dance at the American Legion, as well as drawings for vintage airplane rides, sky sailing, and a handmade quilt. Main Street closes at 9 a.m., so arrive early to enjoy this patriotic event in historic Julian. For full details, visit julianparade.com.
The City of El Cajon invites you to celebrate Independence Day with numerous games, live musical entertainment, and fireworks on July 4th. The El Cajon Recreation Department will host the event at Kennedy Park on East Madison Avenue in El Cajon. From 1 p.m. to 8 p.m., you can enjoy carnival rides, an inflatable, a kiddie train, and a skate park. Free crafts and family games will be available from 2 to 6 p.m., with music by two live bands from 3 to 9 p.m. A fireworks show with synchronized music at 9 p.m. will provide a finale to the celebration of our nation's birthday. For details, go to the City of El Cajon's website.
The City of Santee invites you to celebrate Independence Day at Santee Salutes, held on July 4th from 2:30 p.m. to 10 p.m. at Town Center Community Park East. Visitors can rock out with live music, see a patriotic ceremony, enjoy a kids' fun zone, and a spectacular fireworks display at 9 p.m. For details, visit the City of Santee's webpage and click the events calendar.
That's all for this week.
If you have an event you'd like added to our calendar, or if you would like to sponsor the Destination East County column on our website, or the Destination East County show on KNSJ Radio, you can contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is the most read feature on our website.
We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County. See you around, East County.
This is Liz Albert with a baseball report from Grossmont College. A year after dislocating his kneecap while swinging at a pitch after his cleat became lodged in the rubberized batting box at Petco Park, West Hills alum and Grossmont College left-handed pitcher Jeremiah Barr made up lost time en route to a state championship. Barr registered half of the 10 outs he recorded on strikes in relief, lifting Grossmont College to the state CCCAA Community College title after taking down defending titleist Santa Rosa Junior College 10-6 on Memorial Day Monday to take the best-of-three series in three games. For Barr, a left-hander who started the season slowly to rebuild strength in his knee, eventually became the Griffins' closer, which meant he was often pitching for the save. Instead, the freshman collected his first victory of the season for the G-House in the biggest contest of the 17 campaign. The Bear Cubs fell to 38-11. The Griffins led from wire to wire, although the Bear Cubs fought back on several occasions. Two runs in the third and fourth inning gave Grossmont a 4-1 lead. But when Santa Rosa scored in the fourth and were threatening to take the lead, Barr was called upon to take over for 6'5" righty Dylan Gargis. In the seventh, the Barrow Cubs scored three times to move within 6-5, but Grossmont answered with four markers in the eighth to seal the school's first state baseball crown. Grossmont first baseman Noah Stroll paced the offense by driving in four runs. Designated hitter and Granite Hills alum Robert Bostad started the inning with a three-run double, then scored when Stroll also doubled. Both Bostad and Stroll both battled 3-for-5 to pace a 14-hit attack. Grossmont captured the series opener 3-0 as Griffin's freshman pitcher Tim Holdgraffer ran his record to 11-0. In Game 2, Santa Rosa held on to win 5-4 as another former West Hills pitcher, sophomore Donovan McChrystal, tossed four solid innings but came away with no decision.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Liz Alper, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, and Pond 5. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.